compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning and welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. I hope you enjoyed your 21-hour rest. I did, but I was thinking about you the whole time and looking forward to getting back to you. My number is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. I've been watching the news avidly as the situation deteriorates in Israel. We've got a little bit of CNN reportage from Israel about the ongoing violence between Hamas in Gaza. The Gaza Strip is a strip of land in southwestern Israel. It's got the Mediterranean on the west, and then it borders with Israel on the north, east, and south. And the millions of Palestinian folk who are there are being exploited by Hamas, which is a terrorist organization and bent on the destruction of Israel and Jews in general. And so over the last 48 hours or so, there has been an alarming escalation in rockets being fired from Gaza into Israel. I looked at a map yesterday of all the places where the rockets have been hitting, and the Iron Dome system seems to be working pretty well, shooting down most of them. But as of last night, I think there were 700 rockets that had been fired from Gaza into Israel. And looking at that map, they go way up as far as Haifa, and all in the southern area. They seem to be focusing on bombarding Tel Aviv. The airport there is closed. People are dying on both sides, and it's a tragedy for both groups of people. And one aspect of this that I don't see reported as much in the mainstream media, but I'd like to mention this before we go to that audio, is the fact that Hamas, in a cowardly way, they exploit the innocent people, the innocent Palestinian people, the women, the children, the old people, the families, the moms, the dads, and they intentionally use them as human shields and use their homes or their apartment buildings, their stores, things like that, from which to launch their attacks on Israel. So part of the tragedy is when the Israelis respond in kind and they shoot back, inevitably, it seems, there are innocent people who are harmed and killed, many of them, because of Hamas using them as human shields. That is grotesque and part of the problem, but I don't know what solution there is at this point. So here is some audio from this morning from CNN on the scene in Israel.
Air raid sirens have continued to wail in southern Israel all this morning as the Israeli military says it continues to target Gaza militants in the Gaza Strip. All of this coming as the UN Middle East envoy is warning that the tensions here are close to reaching an all-out war.
An exchange of airstrikes and rockets between Israeli forces and Palestinian militants, with tensions in the region escalating into dangerous new levels. Sirens blaring through the streets of Lod near Tel Aviv, a warning of incoming rockets launched by Palestinian militant groups in Gaza. And in Tel Aviv, people running for cover as rockets lit up the sky, some of more than 1,000 fired into Israel so far this week, with its air defense system intercepting most of them. Hamas saying the most recent attacks were in response to Israeli airstrikes. And earlier, its leader vowed they will not back down.
If Israel wants to escalate, we are ready for it. And if it wants to stop, we're also ready.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu sending a warning of his own.
Hamas and the Islamic Jihad will pay for this, and they will pay a heavy price.
Meanwhile, in Gaza, the destruction from hundreds of Israeli missiles is evident. This tower block completely collapsing. The Israeli army saying it was a key Hamas intelligence site, and others heavily damaged. And with hundreds of injuries, the human cost of the conflict is high and likely to grow. Israeli airstrikes have killed at least 35 people in Gaza, including 12 children, according to Palestinian health officials. And at least 5 Israelis have been killed by rocket fire, the Israeli military said. The international community calling for calm in the region and condemning the attacks, including in the United States, where President Joe Biden has received a briefing on the ongoing violence from his national security advisor.
Since last week, he has directed his team to engage intensively with senior Israeli and Palestinian officials, as well as leaders throughout the Middle East. His team is communicating a clear and consistent message in support of de-escalation, and that is our primary focus.
And this is a quickly developing situation, John. We are receiving some updated numbers. In the past hour or so, the death toll in Gaza, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health there, says it's been at least 45 people, including 13 children. Israeli military says they've killed at least 20 militants. In Israel, there have been at least five killed by rockets. And just in the past few hours, the Israeli military says an anti-tank missile was fired from Gaza. Three Israelis were wounded, one of them possibly fatal.
Okay, so that's the reportage as of today from CNN, courtesy CNN. We thank them for that. My number is 888-914-9149. Certainly, if there ever were an urgent prayer need, especially today, it would be praying for both sides, the Palestinians and the Israelis. And hopefully this problem will subside rather than escalate. Let's go to the phones, 888-914-9149. Why don't we start with, I think it's Pete in Rockford, Illinois. Good morning, Pete.
Hi, Patrick. Pete, it is, yes. I'd like to know what your authority is on stating that Hamas is using the Palestinians. The Palestinians, if you were to poll them, which I don't think that you have any idea of, would overwhelmingly support Hamas. Hamas represents the Palestinians, for better or worse, whatever your perspective is. But Hamas...
Yeah. Okay, just let me interrupt you here. I don't know what authority you have to say all those things. I don't need authority to say anything one way or the other. I'm giving my impression based upon my consumption of the news, my following the story for years, and in the few times that I have visited Israel, speaking to some Palestinians. And some of the Palestinians I've spoken to in Jerusalem and Bethlehem, and in some cases have spoken for quite some time, they don't monolithically support Hamas. And bear in mind that not all Palestinians are Muslim. There are a goodly number of Palestinians, not too many left anymore after the Intifada, but there are any number of Palestinians who are Christian, many of whom are Catholic. So it's incorrect for you to suggest that there is this monolithic endorsement of Hamas among Palestinians. It could be that the majority of them do side with Hamas, but there are any number who don't. So I think that's enough to answer your question. I appreciate your phone call today. Thank you. 888-914-9149. Cyrus, I'm having an issue here with my screen. Okay, Ted in Torrance, California. It's good to have you on the program. Welcome, Ted.
Say that racism is a sin, and furthermore, which of the early church fathers addressed the topic of racism?
None of the early church fathers addressed the topic of racism. And the place in the Bible where it says that you shouldn't be racist, it's in the same chapter where it says don't obliterate cities in nuclear war. It's in the same section. In other words, it doesn't say that in the Bible. There are any number of passages. There are any number of passages that talk about how we should love one another, how we should see each other as equals. There is no difference, St. Paul says, between Jew or Greek, free or slave. We are all equal in God's eyes. Plenty of those things that are sufficient to infer that racism is a sin. I don't know whether you're defending racism by way of your question or if you yourself are against it. I'm against it. But the last point, then I'll throw it back to you, is that I don't need to furnish any verse from the Bible to prove this, because the Bible nowhere says that you have to prove anything in the Bible. So just as I don't have to cite a passage that is non-existent about killing people through nuclear war, I don't have to cite a Bible passage to know that what the Bible does say about killing, let's say the fifth commandment, that in itself would cover issues that are more modern that are not mentioned by name there, but the principles are still the same. I'll throw it back to you. What's your thought?
Excellent. Yeah, great point. My thought is that it could all be summed up with four words: love God, love man. So I bring mm-hmm. this up because I just read the Open Wide Our Hearts and Enduring Call to Love, a pastoral level letter against racism. And it seems that too often the U.S. bishops strain at a gnat and swallow the camel, that I think a more prevailing sin throughout the church is pornography, masturbation, contraception, etc. I think that's destroying the more lives of young Catholics as opposed to racism.
Yeah, I would not argue that point. I don't believe the narrative that this country is fundamentally racist or that all white people are racist or any particular group are racist. I don't believe that. And I don't accept the narrative. I realize you're not promoting that narrative, but if we're talking about numerically in terms of things that the greatest number of people do that are either sinful or in some other way problematic, sure, I agree. I think most people are not racist. So numerically, fewer people are committing that sin than are committing some of the sins that you just mentioned, which I think is the point you're making. Am I right? Hello? Okay, well, do we still have our caller or no?
Hey, Ted. Okay, I guess he's done.
Maybe it's a cell phone issue. Sometimes that happens where you can't hear the other person. So, I mean, let's stop and look at that for a second. It's an interesting question. Racism is a prevalent problem, no question about that. But if we were to catalog, and I don't know how you could, but if you were to catalog the number of times somebody falls into that particular sin versus the number of times that they might fall into some sexual sin or theft or, you know, any number of other things, I think that the racism number would be smaller, just numerically. So those are my thoughts on that. Now, you mentioned I guess we don't have our caller anymore, but he mentioned that the U.S. bishops are straining at gnats and swallowing camels. Well, I mean, what can I tell you? I don't know that the bishops have ever written an encyclical on, or a pastoral letter rather, on pornography and the dangers of pornography. That would be a very timely thing. Now, maybe they have, and I just missed it somehow. I don't remember ever hearing about that, but it's not necessarily the case that they haven't spoken out in some official way on that topic. Actually, it's a good homework assignment. I'll have to find out about that. But in any case, the bishops issuing pastoral letters, think about this for a minute. When was the last? Let me ask you this, Cyrus. You could be my thought experiment. What was the last pastoral letter from the U.S. bishops that you read? And I'm not trying to. I'm not making fun. I'm really not making fun. But I'm guessing your answer is going to be none of them.
I can't think of what the titles are. No. Okay. Well, yes, none. Let's go with none.
I think most people, the vast majority of people, that's what they would say. So, on the one hand, maybe if there's some, you know, if the shoe fits, put it on kind of thing, if there is something to his point or his comment that the bishops are talking about a sin that may be not as prevalent as other sins, and why don't they talk about the other sins? Well, who's going to read those anyway? And that's, I don't say that to be disrespectful to the bishops, but the average person probably, unless they're listening to relevant radio, they probably don't even know that those exist, much less do they read them. So even if the U.S. Bishops Conference were to begin cranking out a new pastoral letter on all the major problems that we face, I don't know that many people would even see them. So nowadays, we live in a time of new media, of course. Nowadays, it seems that really the best way to reach people is through YouTube and through TikTok and apps. I know that may sound funny or it may sound frivolous. It's not frivolous. We have to reach the people where they are. So I'm aware that maybe a bishop or two here or there might listen to this program, and who knows who's listening right now. But for what it's worth, I would offer that as a humble proposal that if the U.S. bishops really want to reach people where they are and send a message that they will actually encounter, they'll actually see it, I would really crank up the YouTube presence. And I would make sure that bishops, for example, I would make sure that if you're going to send out a pastoral letter, that you do it on YouTube. that you sit in front of a, you know, a green screen or have a set in the background or something and read the pastoral letter in front of a camera and put it out maybe in parts if necessary, if it's that long, but put it out on YouTube and then make sure that people are aware of it. You'd be surprised how many people would follow those things, because then it's in a medium that not only is accessible to them for the most part, because everybody's looking at their phones anyway. Everybody's looking at their phones. Look at Cyrus right there. He's looking at his phone right now. No, I'm just kidding, Cyrus. You're working hard.
I was looking for the camera.
You're the hardest working man in this studio. In that studio. You see my point? So in other words, if there were maybe an attempt to reach out to the faithful in that way, YouTube, I think, would be a very good way to do it because, of course, everybody is familiar with it. The other thing, too, is that many people nowadays, and I think this is true for adults of most ages, but certainly it's true of young people, it seems to me, our attention spans have been greatly reduced. And a lot of that has to do with the way in which information is given to us. When you think back on how television was, say, like a news program, you know, with Walter Cronkite, and that's the way it is. Well, when Walter Cronkite was on TV, there was no Chiron down at the bottom. There were no moving images. There were no tickers or crawlers or whatever they call those things where information is going. You look at CNN today or Fox News or MSNBC, there's constant motion. There's so much happening on that screen, not just the person who's talking. You've also got the stock information and the weather and all kinds of other things are happening simultaneously. So I think that we live in a time now where most of us have been conditioned to receive information in very small, quick bursts. So by comparison with, say, Walter Cronkite, his news program didn't have any of those things. And it would be just him. He would just be sitting there with his stack of papers talking. By comparison now, that would seem very boring to most people. They probably wouldn't watch it. A lot of movies have the same thing, and even perhaps some television shows where the long form of a scene where the camera doesn't move very much or there's not any real motion or anything, we don't view things that way anymore. So for that reason, among others, I think making use of the new media that we have available to us is a very, I think, a very smart way to go about it. And kind of tagging on to what that caller said a few minutes ago, that would be a great way to reach more people. Now, there is a downside. The downside is that YouTube might censor you. So if you put out a pastoral letter on, let's say, gender ideology, that probably is going to get taken down from YouTube because they don't want people to hear that side of things. They don't want people to know the other side of the story. They only want you to know a certain narrative. So whether it's a lifestyle issue, a sexual issue, gender ideology, if they don't agree with your perspective, they will make it nearly impossible for you to share it on those platforms. So that's something else to be aware of. And this is why some alternative platforms have actually cropped up. I'm looking at the clock, Cyrus. It looks like we need to take a break. We'll do that. My number is 888-914-9149. We can get you on the air. If you call in, 888-914-9149. You can't win if you don't play, right? So call in and we'll get you on the air. 888-914-9149. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. Hey, Cyrus, I don't know if you heard about the voter suppression going on in England. Have you heard about that yet?
Tell me more.
Oh, my gosh. Just the racism, the Jim Crow. This is in England.
In England, too?
Yeah. The Queen's speech yesterday to the House of Lords in Parliament. Can you believe the gall? She announced that Britons will now have to show a photo ID to vote in elections.
They didn't already have to show an ID to vote in elections?
I mean, I'm so sick of this nonsense about voter suppression, because you would be asked to, I mean, if these laws were to be enacted, you would be required to show your driver's license or, you know, maybe a passport or something to vote, just to make sure that you are who you say you are.
Doesn't everybody? I'm lost. Don't they already have that?
Let me walk you through this.
Thanks.
So if you go to the airport and you want to take a trip somewhere, what do you have to show when you get to the ticket counter?
Your passport and ID.
Yeah. You can't get on a plane. Yeah. Now, is that airline travel suppression?
No, I don't think so.
No, you know what it is it's keeping you safe when you're on an airplane, because there are bad people out there who would like to get on airplanes and do bad things. So one of the layers of defense that we have is to prevent those people from getting on airplanes and doing bad things. We require people to show an ID. Now, that's obviously not the only way in which we can safeguard commercial airline travel, but that's an important thing, I think. You know, to say I really am who I say I am. When you go to the doctor's office, if they don't know you well, oh, hey, Cyrus, how you doing? But if like you're signing up to be a new patient at a dentist or a doc, you have to show ID.
Yeah.
If you want to buy,
saying that this is racist because you have to show an ID to vote?
Yeah. In other words, they've been attacking some measures in Congress that have been raised to try, and I mean, I should say in state legislatures, to require voting with an ID as a means to vote, and they call that suppression. So I don't agree with their take on it. I don't believe that it's suppression, and they try to weave into the narrative Jim Crow laws and things, and I'm only talking about this particular issue. I don't want to see anybody in any way who should be voting prevented from voting. I believe that everybody who has, the right to vote should have the ability to vote unimpeded. Every single person, regardless of skin color, regardless of where you live, regardless of what your background may be, if you have the right to vote, then you should be free to vote without any difficulty whatsoever. And showing your ID is not a difficulty. It's more difficult.
Yeah. It's really not.
Yeah, it's no more difficult than showing your ID if you're going to buy a bottle of wine. And you know, like me, you look really young and people don't realize that you're not 21 or over. Ha ha. That was a joke, Cyrus. You're supposed to laugh at that.
I never get carded. I'm trying to think of how. So can you just use like the race card for anything that if there's a party you don't like and they're doing something, can you just say, oh, that's what they're doing is racist?
Some people do that. I don't do that. I think it's racist in itself to do that, but no, I don't.
Exactly. Thank you.
Yeah. So let's get back to the Queen, because this is the big story. And you notice that CNN is not, you know, having a conniption fit about voter suppression in England, because the Queen announced that, you know, the English folk, the UK folk, if they want to vote, they have to show ID. This is just common sense. And I watched it in Parliament. She spoke for like 8 or 10 minutes, something like that. And that was something that kind of popped up on a few radar screens. But it's not voter suppression there any more than it is here to ask somebody to show an ID. And that's my take on that. So we'll get a link to that article, or I suppose you will, Cyrus, that article that talks about that.
You're suppressing me.
Am I? How am I suppressing? I didn't ask you to show me ID before you came into the studio.
That's all right. I got nothing then.
But I'm sure that if you find something, you'll let me know. Thank you. Hey, I thought this was funny, and we will go to the phones here, 888-914-9149. A Milwaukee bakery. This is clever. A Milwaukee bakery prints photos of an alleged thief on its cookies. A Wisconsin bakery has ID'd a thief who ripped off cash and equipment from the store last month, because they got a photo. They got, you know, video of the guy. So now, because they can do this, I don't know how they do this, but bakeries can put pictures on cakes and things like that. So they have this guy's picture all over millions of cookies. Could you imagine if you're the thief? Yeah. It actually is. I think it's kind of funny.
It is funny. It's hilarious.
The owners of the Canfora Bakery, I hope I'm saying the name correctly, Canfora Bakery, in Milwaukee say that the thief broke into the store. This is courtesy of the New York Post. Broke into the store on April 19th and stole the stuff that he stole, but not before his image was caught on a security camera. So the bakers used their crime-fighting skills to create an icing image of the alleged perp on sugar cookies and handed the edible wanted posters on to customers. The bakery wrote on Facebook last month, "We made delicious sugar cookies with his image on them. We invite the Bayview community to come in and take a bite out of the thief while supplies last."
That's awesome.
If you recognize this man, please call the... Wouldn't you feel weird if, like, you came home, like, if you're that guy and you came home and your kids have cookies with your picture on it taken by a security camera as you were robbing the place? That would be unsettling, I should think.
The next thing he's going to do is break back in there to eat all those cookies. He has to get rid of that evidence.
I love the ingenuity. I love it. 888-914-9149. Speaking of ingenuity, this is also kind of bizarre, but it involves technology. Researchers in Singapore, according to Asia One, have found a way of controlling Venus flytrap plants, using a smartphone. It's an innovation that they hope will have a range. I mean, what possible use could you have for controlling a Venus flytrap? I could see you, Cyrus, if you had a way to control your children from your cell phone, you'd never get out of your Barca Lounger. I mean, you'd be in the Barca Lounger permanently, and all you'd have to do is just tap an app and control your children's behavior, take out the trash. I could see it.
I would gladly use an app that somehow let me control my children. I'm losing more and more control every day.
Yeah, there should be an app for that. Singapore's Nanyang Technological University showed in a demonstration how a signal from a smartphone app sent to tiny electrodes attached to the plant could make its trap close as it does when catching a fly. So when somebody says, shut your trap, you can actually tap an app and make it happen with the Venus flytrap. Plants are like humans. One of the professors involved in the study and the research says, plants are like humans. They generate electric signals like the ECG, electrocardiogram for our hearts. We developed a non-invasive technology to detect those little electrical signals from the surface of the plants without damaging them. The scientists have also detached the trap portion of the Venus flytrap and attached it to a robotic arm so it can, when given a signal, grip something thin and light like a piece of wire. In this way, and I love this part of the article, in this way, the plant could be used as a soft robot scientist. I think that would be a great band name, soft robot. The scientists say to pick up fragile things that might be damaged by industrial grippers. That could be another good band name. The industrial grippers, opening for soft robot. I mean, literally opening for soft robot. We are exploring using plants as living sensors to monitor environmental pollution like gas, toxic gas, or water pollution. One of the researchers says, if a plant can talk back to us, maybe growing all these plants may be even easier. So that's happening. So now you have a whole new reason for the Venus flytrap collection that you've nurtured over the years, Cyrus. Just think of the possibilities.
So many.
Yeah. Do we have some more phone calls, I think, waiting, don't we? Good morning, Devin in Providence. Welcome.
Hey, my question for you, Patrick, is with the Liturgy of the Hours, why were there three or so psalms omitted and various other lines of other psalms omitted from those?
Well, I can only venture a guess, but when the liturgical reform movement was underway in the 40s, well, it started even a little bit before the 40s, but let's say certainly by the 40s and 50s, and by the time we have Pope Pius XII as Pope, who is sort of superintending the liturgical revisions that were being proposed, one of them was to revise and simplify the Liturgy of the Hours, or the breviary, as it's known. Priests and religious would read the office every day. And so one of a couple things that were done was the omission of some of the psalms and other things to reduce the amount of it and also to translate it into the vernacular for priests and others who had some difficulty with Latin. So I think that it was at that time that the reduction in some of these prayers or psalms took place. And my understanding is that that was the reason for it, to make it simpler and easier for them to do.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome. I appreciate the phone call. Who's next, Cyrus?
Let's see here. How about Beth in Ohio?
All right. Beth in Ohio, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Patrick. My question is about scrupulosity. And to back up a little bit and give you a little information, over the past 5 years in particular, I would say my faith is really getting stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger. And no thanks to you and Relevant Radio for that. I mean, yes, thanks. Plenty of thanks to you.
Oh. I was nervous for a minute. Okay.
No, definitely thanks to you and Relevant Radio for that.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. But so as my faith is getting stronger and better, I'm availing myself of the confessional more often. And I'm finding that the more I confess, the more I think I have to confess. But I'm not sure if I might be crossing over into scrupulosity. Last Sunday, right before I would have gotten up to go to receive the Eucharist, I thought of something that I did that I thought, I didn't have much time to think it through because the lines were starting to form, but I thought to myself, that probably isn't even a venial sin, Nancy, and it's definitely not a mortal one. And she said to me, Nancy said back to me, go. Well, I didn't. And I am going to go to confession this Saturday so that I can then go. But I probably could have. And so I don't want to get into the scrupulosity. I don't want to cross the line into that. And I'm not sure where that line is. So can you help with that?
I will do my best. Yeah. The scrupulosity, for those who may not be familiar with how it's used in this context, is where often somebody who's suffering from that, it magnifies in their mind the gravity of an action that either is a venial sin, but it's magnified in their mind to be something mortal. Or it may not be sinful at all. It may just be an imperfection or a fault, or it may be nothing at all, but yet the scrupulosity causes somebody to kind of obsess over it and feel that they're not virtuous because of that. So much has been written about this by spiritual masters, and in a moment I'll share with you one of the writings that I think would be helpful to you. But suffice to say, if you know intellectually that a given act on your part was not mortal, it was not, you know, gravely sinful, as it says in 1 John chapter 5, that's where we get the term mortal sin. It comes straight out of 1 John chapter 5, where St. John says that all wrongdoing is sin, but there are some sins that are not mortal, some sins that are not deadly, some translations say. So knowing what is required to commit a mortal sin, which includes, for example, the act itself has to be grave matter, you have to have sufficient reflection to realize that doing this would be gravely sinful, and you have to have freedom to choose to do it. So if you're being coerced into something that you know you otherwise would never do, but somebody's forcing you and there's nothing you can do, that would be different. That wouldn't be a mortal sin. You wouldn't be culpable of a mortal sin. So if you're aware, back to your point, if you're aware that this act itself does not have those elements to it and that it's not a mortal sin, then you're not obliged to confess it in confession. Now, you can, and I personally think it's a good idea when you go to confession to confess whatever venial sins you may have, especially if they're habitual and part of your day-to-day failings. That's good because you receive grace and the ability for God to heal those things in you, but you're not obliged to say them. So when you go to Mass, all of your venial sins and all the effects of the venial sins are remitted. So as the venial sins are remitted when you receive Holy Communion, and they're also remitted during the penitential rite in Mass. So I don't know if that gives you a sense of calm, but knowing what you said to me, if you're aware that, well, that I know that for sure isn't a mortal sin, you know with certitude that when you go to Mass, even if it is a venial sin, it would be completely expunged in the penitential rite and if you received Holy Communion. Does that clarify it a little bit for you?
Yeah, it does. It does help me. But I also find that I'm kind of, and I'm overstating this just to make a point, like a revolving door with the confession. I go in, I come out, I think I better go back in. I don't mean that immediately that same day, but
right.
But I'm kind of going around and around in circles. And so I think that, and frankly, I haven't had any mortal sins to confess in about
many
20 years. So that's a good thing.
That is very good.
Yeah, I mean, that I know of, and I think I know, I'm pretty good about an examination of conscience and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But, so that's why I think maybe I'm being scrupulous, that I'm really nitpicking this thing, because the thing that happened Sunday, the maybe a venial, definitely, I thought, not a mortal sin, the more I thought about it, like, well, I don't know, maybe there's more, no, on the surface of it, that doesn't sound like a
well,
mortal
see,
sin.
Well, see, let me jump in here. If it were a mortal sin, you would know it. Because for you to be culpable of a mortal sin, you'd have to say, with sufficient time to think about it and nobody coercing you, you'd have to say, I know that if I do this, I am going to be cutting off my relationship with God. I'm going to be turning away from God in a very serious way, but I'm going to do it anyway. Now, if you're even asking yourself, gee, I wonder if this is a venial sin, but could it possibly, there's no way it could be a mortal sin. Because if it were, in terms of your own culpability, you would already know it. You would already be, yeah, I remember, I'm so ashamed I did that, and I knew that I shouldn't do that, and I knew it would offend God, and I did it anyway. You would already know that. So as a rule of thumb, the fact that you are puzzling over it is sufficient indication, if you ask me, that that is not a mortal sin. For that reason.
Okay. Thank you. That really helps. Thank you, Patrick.
Good. You're welcome. So let me give you a resource, okay? And then we'll have to take a break. Now, St. Teresa of Avila, she was a master, a mistress, I guess would be the word, but we wouldn't use it that way nowadays. But she was a master of the spiritual life. And among her writings, she wrote The Interior Castle. And I want to just touch upon one thing that you said at the beginning of your question, and that is that the more you grow in holiness, the more sensitive your conscience becomes. And there is always the danger of scrupulosity. So we have to be careful to avoid that. But at the same time, and she brings this out in vivid detail as she describes the various levels of progress to perfection in the interior life. And this is one of those classic signs of somebody who's growing in maturity and grace and virtue. When their conscience becomes more sensitive, more attuned to the things that maybe out of gross negligence or for whatever reason, they just never really thought about it. But now, as they grow in maturity and they grow closer to the Lord, they become more aware of even the smaller things and the way in which that can impede our relationship with God. So the scrupulosity issue is something to keep an eye on, and maybe you can talk with the priest you go to confession to, or maybe get a spiritual director. But at the same time, though, you can also see that as a sign of progress on your part. And St. Teresa of Avila will take it from here, and she'll take you into much deeper waters. Does that sound good?
That sounds great. Thank you so much, Patrick. I appreciate it.
You're most welcome. Very nice to talk to you.
And again, thank you, and Relevant Radio for everything you've done for me.
You are so welcome. Thanks be to God, right? All right, quick time out. We are moving rapidly through our first hour of the program today. We have two more to come. The number to dial to be on the air is 888-914-9149. I'll be right back. If you don't scrub that kitchen floor,
you ain't gonna rock and roll no more. Yak-a-yak. Don't know, baby. Just
the programming you hear throughout the day on the Relevant Radio Network is sponsored in part by Christendom College. More info at getprinciples.com. We thank them for supporting Relevant Radio.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com. Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now.
Cyrus, this song, Canary in a Coal Mine by The Police, you recognize this song, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's a catchy little tune. Mm-hmm. I got to tell you a quick story, then we're going to go to the phones. I made my dad really mad one time because I was, you know, playing in a band. This would have been mid-1980, something like that. And I and a couple guys from the band were over at my house, and I put this song on a cassette player, and I said, "Hey, Dad, check out one of our new songs." And I played that. It's The Police. And my dad's like, "Wow, that's really good." And he's like really enthusiastic about
it. You might be able to make a living at this after all.
Yeah, he just lit up, and he said, "Oh, that's really good. I really like that." And so we, you know, started grinning at each other, and we had him on for, you know, a minute or so. And then I said, "Dad, I'm just joking. That's not really us. That's some other band." And he actually got mad. He got mad at me. So every time I hear "Canary in a Coal Mine" by The Police, I'm back at the kitchen table with my dad, really liking the thought that his son was playing in a band that could produce that song. And then he got mad.
And then reality dropped.
Yeah, yeah. And I had to tell him because, you know, he was saying like, "You guys should get that on the radio.
Go on the road."
Yeah. So if we, you know, if we just never were successful in any commercial sense, he would always say, you know, he would have wondered, "Well, what about that one song that was pretty good?" So I had to tell him. But thankfully, he doesn't remember that incident. I've asked him about it. He doesn't remember it anymore, but I've never forgotten it. 888-914-9149. We'll go now to Sophia in Prescott. How do you say it in Wisconsin? Is it Prescott, like in Arizona, or Prescott?
It's Prescott.
Prescott. Very well. Well, welcome.
And this is actually Maria, her younger sister.
Oh, okay, Maria. How old are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How old are you?
I'm 12.
Okay. So you must have just turned 12 because you almost said 11 just now.
Yeah, in March.
Good for you. Well, that's good. So are you taking over for Sophia? Did you have a question?
Yeah, I was wondering why they call St. Michael a saint.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. Well, because the word saint in the Bible is, we translate it as saint from the word in Greek that means holy one. And so Sanctus is the Latin translation, and we get the word saint from that Latin word. Hagios would be the Greek word. But because all the good angels are holy, we refer to some of them as saint. So Saint Michael the Archangel was never canonized by the Catholic Church, nor was Saint Gabriel the Archangel or Saint Raphael. Those are the three that we know from the Bible by name. And we call them saints in the Catholic Church because they're holy. By saint, we don't mean that they're canonized, but they're saints in that sense. All the angels are.
Oh, okay.
Does that make sense? Does that help?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Good. So what happened to Sophia? She couldn't stay on the phone?
Well, I was going to answer the question.
Oh, okay. So did I give the answer that you would have given?
No.
Oh, what would you have said?
No, that's the same thing I was going to ask.
Oh, I see. You're going to ask the question. I thought you meant you were going to answer it. Well, very good. So are we all squared away on the angel issue?
Yeah. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. And tell your mom thank you for letting you girls call today. We appreciate it. Nice to chat with you. 888-914-9149. We'll go now to Tim in Front Royal, Virginia. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Patrick. Yes, I've been in the church about 30 years, and I really enjoy the daily liturgy a lot. Yeah. And I was wondering, you might know this, ever since I've been in the church, the collect after the entrance antiphon, mm-hmm. at the end we go, you know, talking about Christ in the resurrection of Christ, your Son, who lives and reigns with you in the unity of the Holy Spirit. It's always been one God forever and ever. And recently, I can't remember how long it's been, but we dropped the one. And now it's just God forever and ever. Do you have any idea why the one was dropped in that prayer?
I do have a sense of it, and that is from what I read a few months ago when this story kind of came onto my radar screen. And I don't have it in front of me, so I'm going from memory, Tim. But as I recall, it's because that word one does not appear in the original Latin. It was an embellishment in English that, you know, I like, and I think it's very good, but it wasn't in the original Latin. So as a way to conform to the original Latin more closely, they dropped it. And I don't think that was a necessary move, but they didn't consult me. It is what it is, but it sort of rolls off the tongue more smoothly and more beautifully, I think, by saying one God totally forever agree. And ever. Yeah. But I think that was the reason. I think it just was, it was not present in the Latin.
In the Latin, interesting. Because that's been, you know, in the tradition, of course, ancient tradition, we've always, in the Jewish tradition, has always been one God, and it seems a little awkward to drop that, but anyway, just, I'm glad you knew why.
Well,
okay, well, hey, thanks.
You got it, Tim, I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, I'm all in favor, as a general principle, I'm all in favor and happy to see whenever our liturgical books and the prayers and such conform as closely as possible, not in a slavishly literal sense, because sometimes if you're slavishly literal, it doesn't translate that well. So sometimes you have to use a manner of speaking that would be understandable to a modern 21st century American audience. But I'm very much in favor of the church's efforts here and there to make the translations into the vernacular languages faithful to the underlying Latin in terms of prayers and things. So I welcome that as a general thing, but as Tim pointed out, sometimes there are changes that are difficult for us because we're so accustomed to saying it a certain way that it's hard to change that. 888-914-9149. We'll go now to Steve, listening in Salem, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve.
All right, Steve Rolo, the Steve Meister, asking me questions.
Making copies.
Yes, my question is, I read the Bible every day for a couple of hours in by the sea here in Salem, and I've noticed a woman who's probably in her, I would guess in her 40s or 50s, I've never spoken to her, and she has a daughter who is probably maybe 17, 18 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And who's severely handicapped, mentally handicapped. Physically, she's fine. She goes all around the water and everything. But it got me to thinking that when she dies, I don't believe that she has the capacity to know Christ. So what will happen to her when she does pass away?
Her mother
is a saint.
Has she been baptized?
I don't know. I've never spoken to these people.
My guess, Steve, is that if these are devoutly religious people, if her mom is devoutly religious, I think the likelihood of this girl having been baptized is through the roof high. So let's assume that for a moment. She would go straight to heaven if she didn't have the mental age of reason. So she would be in the same category as an infant who died after baptism. Or a smaller child who died after baptism. They haven't reached the age of reason, so they're not capable of offending God in any serious way. So by virtue of her baptism, and chances are she may also have been confirmed and may even have received the Holy Eucharist. In the Eastern churches, by the way, Steve, this is just for your good-to-know file, but not only in the Eastern Orthodox churches, but in some of the Eastern Catholic churches, like the Byzantine Rite, infants are baptized and they're confirmed. There they call it chrismation. But they're baptized, they're confirmed, and they receive the Holy Eucharist as little tiny babies. So, you know, a two-week-old child receiving Holy Communion from the spoon that is used to spoon into the mouth. So they have those sacraments of initiation in the East anyway at the very beginning. And I don't know whether this young woman has received any of the other sacraments of initiation, but even if it was just baptism, to answer your question, she would go to heaven because she hasn't committed any sins.
Right. That makes me so happy because her mother is a cross to bear. So when she gets to, she'll meet her daughter in heaven or whatever, and they'll be able to communicate with, talk to each other.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, see, in heaven, that girl will be at the peak of her perfection. And so whatever, you know, disabilities, those will all be gone, and she will be...
That's fantastic.
Isn't it, though?
That's the greatest news I've had. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, and just think, Steve, here's something else.
They're bringing a tear to my eyes.
Let me give you something else to cry joy about. When you get to heaven, you'll meet her in person, and you'll be able to talk with her in heaven about how you were praying for her in this life and how you were admiring her and her mom and their virtue. And just think what it'll be like to have that conversation.
Yeah. Wonderful. Absolutely. Made my day.
Awesome. Thank you, Steve. I love the thought of going to heaven and what that will be like. So I don't want to go quite yet. I've got a few other things I hope I get a chance to do, but in due time. And we'll all have a great reunion. Can you imagine the Patrick Madrid Show listeners reunion that we'll have in heaven? Awesome. I'll be right back.